Mussels, clams, oysters, and scallops have two things in common. They're delicious to eat, and they are all bivalves, invertebrate species encased in two-part hinged shells. Bivalves eat by filtering water through their gills, removing nutrients, algae, and even pollutants. Therefore, bivalves have the power to make our waters clearer and cleaner. It's even estimated that a single adult oyster can filter up to 50 gallons of water a day. So we're talking about bivalves on today's Please Explain. And our guests are Bren Smith, a lifelong commercial fisherman, owner of Thimble Island Oyster Company in Brantford, Connecticut. Gary Wickfors, the biotechnology branch chief in the Aquaculture Enhancement Division of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center of NOAA. And we will be joined a little later by Sam Ingber, executive chef of the Grand Central Oyster Bar. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
And if any of our listeners have questions about these types of shellfish, how to prepare them for eating, how they're grown or harvested, their relationship to the greater environment, you can give us a call. Our number is 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org or tweet us at Leonard Lopate. Bren, where's your shellfish farm located?
Sure. I'm located just up the coast from New Haven, Connecticut, in these beautiful little islands called the Thimble Islands.
And should I say you grow things?
Yeah, so we grow a mix of oysters, mussels. We do seaweeds like kelp. We do oysters, and we also harvest sea salt off our farm. Really, the idea is how many different species can we grow in a 20-acre area, but only species that are restorative, so species that improve environmental quality ocean ecosystems, but still produce sort of good, delicious food for local communities.
Do you grow them all together, or are they separated?
Yeah, I have a what we call 3D or vertical farming method where we grow everything's grown integrated. So, for example, the kelp and the mussels grow vertically. They hang from the surface and hang down about 12 feet. Below that are cages with oysters in them, and then below in the mud we have clams. So it's a very efficient use of space with a small footprint because we're using the whole water column, and it's pretty affordable to do because we don't have to fight gravity, so it doesn't take a lot of structure.
You've been a commercial fisherman since you were 14. What got you into bivalves?
Yeah, so sort of a journey of ecological redemption, because my personal history follows sort of the history of the oceans environmentally. So I've fished in the Bering Sea and in Gloucester, up in George's Banks and the Grand Banks, and really it was at the height of factory fishing. So it was just chasing fish on huge factory trawlers, incredible amounts of bycatch. I mean, it was a pretty brutal process, but, you know, I was a kid, and this is what I knew how to do, and I loved it. While I was out on the Bering Sea, the cod stocks crashed in my home. I'm born and raised in Newfoundland, Canada, and that was sort of a wake-up call for a whole generation of us who went on then on this search for how do we work on the sea, spend our lives on our boats, but do it in a different way. And so I went to the aquaculture farms, and that was more of the same. They were sort of like Iowa pig farms in the ocean, highly polluting, using antibiotics, terrible feed, things like that, and then kept on searching. And I ended up, like a lot of people my generation, I think, in fishermen, and increasingly so, in Long Island Sound, and leased some grounds because they had a program to attract young fishermen back into the fisheries by leasing oyster grounds. So I started oysters and then just went from there.
And you also run something called Green Wave. What's that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been farming for close to 15 years now, and our method of farming is, we feel like it's very replicable. Basically, anybody with 20 acres and a boat and about $30,000 can start their own farm and be growing incredible amounts of food very quickly. So Green Wave is our replicator. It teaches farmers, new farmers how to grow. We're building a seafood hub, so there's a place to aggregate product. We have a new bivalve and seaweed food truck that we're going to be putting on the road. And so that's really an effort to grow this new industry, because we believe this nexus between job creation, food, and environmental restoration is sort of exactly the kind of industries of the future we want to create.
Gary, what sort of work do you do in your laboratory in Milford, Connecticut?
The Milford Laboratory is actually world-renowned for our history and our current work, we like to consider ourselves to be the birthplace of modern bivalve aquaculture. It's the first place that shellfish like oysters and clams were spawned and reared in captivity, and scientists here have determined what kind of conditions the young stages need. We figured out nutrition of larvae to produce seed. And more recently, we're still doing some of that research, but we've moved our work out into the environment to quantify in a scientific way the kind of environmental benefits that Bren has talked about already.
Well, you mentioned nutrition. What do bivalves eat, and how do they eat? They don't have mouths.
They do have mouths, but the way they feed is they have a gill that looks a bit like a fish gill, so it's a flat structure, and there are cilia, little tiny hairs all over the cells on the gill, and those cilia create water currents that draw water through the shell and capture single-celled plants and other small particles. Single-celled plants can be known as microalgae or phytoplankton, and those are the grasses of the sea, really. So when you're growing a bivalve out the way Bren does in natural waters, you're sort of putting them out in a pasture where the natural plankton grow. The bivalves, as I said, they pass the water through their shells, capture the particles, move them to the mouth, and sort of the very amazing thing they can do is to detect the difference between a nutritious particle, a microalgal cell or a detrital particle, and a piece of sand. And they spit out the sand that they can't use, and they, using organs on their mouth, they ingest the useful portion of what's floating around in the water.
Where does the figure that one oyster can filter 50 gallons of water a day come from?
I've read that so many times and in so many places that I questioned it myself about a year ago. Somebody asked me if it was true, and I went back to the original literature on filtration rates of oysters per gram of dry weight body and, you know, figured out the weight of an adult oyster, and it came out to 50 gallons a day. I couldn't believe it, but that is an accurate number based on scientific studies.
Listeners are wondering if shellfish are filtering nitrogen, algae, pollutants, filtering toxins from the water. How can they be safe to eat?
Well, to begin with, they are actually not filtering nutrients or pollutants. They're capturing the microalgae that have grown using the nutrients. And in some places, microalgae can be contaminated with toxic compounds, and shellfish can become contaminated. But those places are only very, very extreme places of very, very high industrial pollution. And you know, there are laws and controls in the United States that really protect consumers from that. Now, that said, a lot of people talk about nitrogen as though it's a pollutant, and when there's too much of it in a given embayment or body of water, it can be considered a nuisance. But nitrogen itself is an essential part of proteins. It's one of the four most abundant elements in living tissue, in human beings. So nitrogen is a really essential nutrient that we all need, and the bivalves acquire nitrogen in the form of protein from algae, create oyster protein, and that's very nutritious for us. So that whole nitrogen cycle, the way oysters work with that, is actually a very good thing for the environment and a good thing for human nutrition.
My guests are Gary Wickfords, the biotechnology branch chief of the Aquaculture Enhancement Division of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and Bren Smith, a lifelong commercial fisherman, owner of Trimble Island Oyster Company in Brantford, Connecticut. And joining us now is Sam Ingber, executive chief of the executive chef at Grand Central Oyster Bar. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're talking about bivalves on today's Please Explain. Sam, welcome to our show. Now, why can some shellfish be eaten raw while others are better cooked? Sam.
Sandy,
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Most shellfish have a chance of getting bacteria. So it's very important that you're getting fresh shellfish right out of the water. And from waters that come from certified waters. Oysters, clams, any bivalve has to come from a certified water by the USDA. So that's the most important thing. And by cooking them, it kills off any of these bacteria. So it's important to have sushi quality shellfish.
Bivalves cook fast. How can you make sure that they don't wind up overcooked?
It depends. If they're in the shell and closed, they take longer. Bivalves that are open already cook very, very fast.
The ones that, where they're closed, you can cook them until they open?
The second they open, they're basically cooked, yes.
So that, but what happens when you have a whole different group of bivalves in the same paella, for example? Aren't they going to be opening at different times?
I put them in layers, knowing that hard shell clams take the longest, mussels are short, shrimp cook in 2 minutes, so I just make them in different layers.
How do you clean shellfish?
Most of it just cold running water with a brush, if you have a brush, or a wet towel.
The biggest problem for people who want to have oysters at home is the shucking. Good way to cut yourself, to really hurt yourself. Are there certain tricks to shucking?
One of the biggest tricks is put a folded towel in the palm of your hand. Okay, oyster knives are usually sharp. So if you put the oyster with the little hinge facing you towards the bottom, and you take the oyster and put it in the palm of your hand with the towel first, if the knife slips, it goes into the towel.
Can I use a screwdriver? Just stick it in the joint?
You probably can. Make sure it's not rusty.
Bren, how does the local environment affect the flavor of a bivalve?
Yeah, so we call it a miroir, and it's
as opposed to a terroir.
Exactly, because it's water temps, salinity, the amount of nutrients, the depth of the water all give you a different taste. Our oysters, Thimble Island salts, are like a splash of salt water with a bit of sweetness on the end. And what we're really seeing is all up and down our coasts, we're kind of getting a Napa Valley of oysters with each little cove having a different flavor. And I think that really makes it fun for consumers because you get a plate, sort of a map of our farms up and down the coast when you order up a serving oysters.
Do different bivalves require different growing conditions? Does a clam, for example, want to be in a different place than an oyster?
Yeah, so clams like the mud. So they like to sink in, and they're able to wiggle around so they can still breathe. Oysters, actually, if in mud, they'll drown. So they want to be either on a sandy or rocky bottom, or we grow them in cages and bags. Mussels, we do in the full water column, like I said. We raise those sort of higher in the top half of the water column. So the part of the trick as a farmer is really figuring out all these different needs of our different crops and giving them what they need.
Do all bivalves reproduce in the same way?
That's a science question. I mean,
okay, let's ask Gary then.
Yeah.
Gary?
Yeah, so
do they? I mean,
most of the bivalves we've talked about so far are what's called broadcast spawners, in which the females release eggs into the water, the males release sperm into the water, and they meet by chance. There's one exception to that, and that is the European flat oyster, the Bellons that are famous from France. And those, the female actually broods the larvae. So the female holds the eggs, they're fertilized inside the shell, and the larvae are brooded inside the shell for a while.
Wow.
But that's really an exception. Generally speaking, it's all happening out externally in the water.
Do they need different types of nutrition at different stages of life?
We have found, in fact, that larvae are much more demanding because they have not got enough flesh. They don't have enough mass to them to store nutrients, critically important food components like some fatty acids. So every day a larva needs a nutritionally complete diet, whereas adults, if they get a really good dose of one kind of algae one part of the season, they can store some of the important components from that algae for the rest of the season and use it as they need it to grow.
You've compared the algae you cultivate in your lab to the Burpee seed catalog.
Yes, we have a collection of pure cultures of algae in the lab here, about 230 strains. we've identified maybe 10 of those that are exceptionally good foods for different larvae and post-set of bivalves. And in addition to the research we have, we actually send hundreds of little starter cultures to hatcheries all around the United States to start their feed cultures, to feed their larvae. So that's how it's the burpee seed catalog. We have the starter, the seed cultures to send out to hatcheries.
Do oysters and clams that get better nutrition grow bigger, or is it just a genetic thing?
Well, certainly up until some maximum amount you feed them, you can get faster growth. And we've actually worked that all out, how much to feed to young stages to maximize their growth. As far as when they get older, there's certainly a genetic component. But part of it is, like any of us, when we reach a certain size, we stop growing. And some bivalves grow more than others. There, I've seen pictures of Pacific oysters that are as big as your foot. That's
wow.
Unusual in the bivalve world.
My guests are Gary Wickfors, the biotechnology branch chief of the Aquaculture Enhancement Division of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center of NOAA. Also, Bren Smith, a lifelong commercial fisherman and owner of Thimble Island Oyster Company in Bradford, Connecticut, and Sandy Ingber, executive chef at the Grand Central Oyster Bar. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll take your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we are back with today's Please Explain Look at Bivalves with Sandy Ingber, executive chef at the Grand Central Oyster Bar, Bren Smith, owner of Thimble Island Oyster Company, and Gary Wickfors, the biotechnology branch chief of the Aquaculture Enhancement Division of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center of NOAA. And we're inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Let's begin with Bill from Old Bridge, New Jersey. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. You're one of the most likable guys on the radio. I love your show.
Oh, thank you so much. I like you, too.
You know, my wife and I eat an awful lot of bivalves, and a lot of times it's clams and mussels. And I always cook with a lot of white wine, you know, a little garlic, a little oil. And you can even drink it afterwards, the soup that it makes. But during Ramadan, she doesn't want me to use the wine. And I've tried a couple things. Nothing seems to come out nearly as good. I was wondering if...
Sandy? Sandy, what do you think?
I just think you got to use a lot of herbs and spice it up a little bit.
Now, Sandy, are you one of those people who cringes when you see people put horseradish or ketchup on a nice briny oyster?
Well, I always tell them to eat the first one naked with nothing on it. Get a full flavor of the profile. And then put anything else you want on the next one.
Do you think that those things go well with oysters?
Absolutely. Vinegar sauce, cocktail sauce, it's whatever you like goes well. But try the first one naked.
Ted from Greenwich, Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Love your show, too. I feel lucky to have two people on from Milford and Brantford, so I could ask my personal question. We have a beach house, and I've had a beach house in Guilford, Connecticut, for about 70 years. It's the next town up from Brantford. And we always are clamming in those waters. And sometimes I pause and think, am I eating clams that are, you know, are okay for me or healthy for me? You had mentioned something about certified waters, and I'm just wondering if that area off Sachem's Head in Guilford is certified water.
I have we actually grow right there. There's some commercial grounds right off of Sachem's Head, and the it's fine to eat there, as long as, you know, there are signs up that you look for whether the grounds are open or closed. I'm sure you've seen that. I mean, this question of sort of polluted versus not unpolluted waters. Our view is we grow in different places. So oysters, shellfish are one of the most traceable foods, highly regulated foods in the country. I always say you wish your tomatoes and arugula were treated the same in the food system as our shellfish. But we also have farms that grow specific that are in dirty areas. For example, Dr. Charlie Yarish out of UConn and Rock the Boat in New York have a farm below Hunts Point in the Bronx River, and the role of that is just to remediate, soak up pollutants, and then that isn't used for the it doesn't go into the food system. So we locate some farms in polluted areas and some farms in our pristine waters.
Thank you for your call, Gary. Climate change stands to affect the bivalve population in the coming years. Have you noticed the waters warming in Long Island Sound where you do your research?
Well, it's not us that's noticed that. There have been some excellent published articles documenting a steady increase in temperature in Long Island Sound, for example, and up the coast. And I don't think many of us are concerned about the physiology of oysters and clams that live here themselves, because those are distributed all the way down to Florida, so they can certainly live in a warmer environment. The kind of things we worry about, though, are changes in the predators that might be present. There are some voracious predators of bivalves to the south of our area, specifically blue crabs and cow nose rays, that eat a lot of oysters and clams in Chesapeake and in that region. And if they find their way north, it's going to be something that farmers like Brent are going to have to contend with in terms of designing their farms to protect their crops from these predators. The other concern that's been mentioned a lot in the press is ocean acidification. And, you know, the first thing I'd mention is that oysters and clams, the bivalves we're talking about, live in estuaries, not the ocean. And so the chemistry is a bit different in estuaries because there's a lot of freshwater mixing. And the carbonate chemistry, the acidity, is affected by a lot of other things that are not relevant in the ocean. But that being said, there's a lot of research being done, and I don't think the research has reached a complete conclusion yet about how resilient bivalves might be to ocean acidification. I think the news might be better than a lot of people fear, but we need a lot more research to really understand how bivalves deal with acidified water and so on.
Well, haven't lobsters been dying off in the Long Island Sound?
Yes. 1999 was the end of lobsters in Long Island Sound. The bottom waters were above the lethal limit for lobsters that year for 70 days.
Do they need a different environment than bivalves?
Yeah, that's a cold water species for sure. And the very southern limit of the distribution of the American lobster was Long Island Sound. The climate has changed enough for them to be really pushed out especially as a commercial species.
Let's go to Russell from Larchmont, New York. Hi, Russell, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I had heard that eating raw bivalves during the summer months was not a good idea. Is that true?
The old R month,
yes,
thing, what do you say, Sandy?
Well, it's kind of a wives' tale now. It used to be true, especially when there was no refrigeration. But nowadays, there's so many different varieties of oysters from all over the country. They all spawn at a different time. And spawn is what you're concerned about during the R months. It's not harmful to eat them, though it's not pleasant, but it will not hurt you. So what happens is there's so many varieties of oysters available, they do not all spawn at the same time. So even in the summer, personally, we have 25 to 30 different kinds of oysters on our menu that are not spawning.
Everybody agree?
Yes, I'll add that an innovation made possible by farming beyond just wild harvest of bivalves, especially oysters, is the capacity to produce triploids. Now, a lot of our agricultural crops are triploids or tetraploids. That is to say, it's not transgenic, it's not genetically engineered, but just extra copies of chromosomes. And what this accomplishes in oysters is actually prevents them from spawning. So even in waters where wild oysters are spawning in the summertime, these triploid oysters that have been produced in hatcheries are not spawning and are still quite delicious.
Now, farm fish are often described as generally not as healthy as wild-caught fish. Does that apply as well to bivalves?
If you're asking me, I'd question your first assumption about farm fish not being healthy.
Well, they're often in very small, held in very small areas. They sometimes they can become ill, and also they don't always taste as good. Salmon that is farm-raised doesn't get that same rich red color that comes from just swimming long distances.
Well, you know, let's stick with bivalves, actually. And so the story is that whether they're growing as you know, kind of natural population or on a farm, the bivalves are all out to pasture in the same pasture, so to speak. They're eating the same natural phytoplankton, whether they're farmed or wild-caught. And so there's no difference in that respect between a farmed and a wild-caught bivalve. And in fact, for a lot of the species we've been talking about, farmed product is far more plentiful on the market than wild-caught. Most of the oysters and clams and mussels, all the mussels you eat, are going to be will have come from a farm where they have been feeding on the same natural plankton most of their lives as a wild specimen would have.
And Sandy, I assume most of the product you get is coming from farms for the oyster bar?
Most of the oysters are farmed, but there's still quite a few wild ones out there. Basically, the one difference is that the farm just started in a laboratory. Then they grow them out and they put them in the same waters. Mm-hmm. So there's not really a whole lot of difference. But farming oysters, they cultivate them by tumbling them. They create a more of an even size, deeper cup, whereas a wild oyster grows wild and could be any shape or size.
Let me just jump in there real quick on the hatchery side. Is that what we do to spawn the oysters? We go out and get, you know, out into the bay, and we find 8 beautiful oysters in the wild, and we take them back, and we look for nice deep cups, good round shape, thick shells, good meats, things like good plump meats, and then we use those 8 oysters in our hatchery in order to spawn. So it's a very natural process. It's not, you know, you think of GMOs and all these things. It's not, you know, that's not what's happening with our bivalves. The other thing just about the farmed aquaculture in general, sort of ocean farming, is that it's probably one of the most innovative sectors, the food and agricultural sector in the country. I mean, I think a third of Monterey Aquarium's best rated seafood now is farmed. And it's because we've got this hangover of a bad branding. One of the worst brands in the grocery store is aquaculture. And that's from the 80s when we picked the wrong species. We picked species that, like you said, weren't disease resistant. We had to feed a lot of wild fish. They tasted terrible. In about the last 5 years, the industry's really begun to revolutionize. And we're growing things like barramundi and seaweeds and bivalves and really changing the seafood plate. And when 90% of wild fish stocks depleted, 1 out of 4 marine species threatened with extinction because of climate change, we really need to figure out how to farm correctly, push the wild fish to the edges, and sort of prepare for this new future.
Let's take a call from Joan from Summers, New York. Hi, Joan. You're on the air.
Hi. I, too, love your show, Leonard. And
I'm feeling so loved today.
I just wanted to ask, at my fish store, I was told that if I wanted him to open the little neck clams for me, I had to buy them the same day, not the day before. You know, if they were unopened, I could buy them the previous day. But opening them, they should be used the same day. Is that correct?
Sandy?
I like to agree with him, but you obviously can do it. It's not as good. They dry out. If you keep them covered with a moist paper towel, more than likely, as long as you keep them iced down the whole time, they'll be fine the next day. But they're nowhere near as good as when you eat them on the same day as you open them. But if you do, make sure they're kept cold the whole time.
Now, Bren, in 2011, the NOAA estimated that the commercial bivalve mollusk fishery brings in about $1 billion annually to the United States. But aren't we importing a lot of our seafood these days? Does that figure stand to change? Are you facing competition from Asia?
Well, I mean, yeah, our seafood, the way we organize it is kind of insane. Paul Greenberg just did a great book called American Catch. And, you know, we're, I forget the numbers. It's like 40% of the fish we're catching we ship overseas and then re-import in. We really need to think through the process. We don't face global competition the same way because we have such a vibrant food movement now. Folks that want good local, sort of highly traceable food, they want to get to know their farmers and fishers. And that's just... That's the cause of this huge explosion of small-scale oyster farms, clam farms, things like that, because the demand has just gone through the roof.
I want to thank you all for being on our show. Bren Smith, the owner of Thimble Island Oyster Company in Bramford, Connecticut. Gary Wickforce, the biotechnology branch chief in the Aquaculture Enhancement Division of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center of the NOAA. And Sandy Ingber, who has been at the Oyster Bar for 25 years and has earned the nickname Bishop of Bivalves. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I thank all of you who have called in. Thank you for participating in today's Please Explain.
It was fun. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you. I had a great time.